Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have Jason on the line here. We still have Larry as well. And Jason brought up a really interesting point relative to evolution that most people don't bother to consider. And I'm going to let Jason tell the story, but let me just preface it by saying that he brought up the eye. Eyes are ubiquitous on most animals, even on most insects. And with the eye, for evolution to have worked, the being would have had to know that there's something to see before the being could have seen what the eye is designed to see. And so it would have had to have striven to develop a capability that it would have had no concept as to what that capability would do. And then you have to deal with the process that it's from an evolutionary point of view to have a being conceived with a fully functioning eye from parents who had no eyes is an impossibility. It has to evolve over time, and yet when you look at the aspects of an eye, unless you have all of them, you have to have a lens which receives light, which and focuses light. You then have to have the retina, which is able to read, distinguish the patterns of that light, and then you have to have an optic nerve that conveys what those images to the brain, and then have a portion of the brain that's able to translate that into something that is meaningful, and then to respond to it. It's and so this notion that a being without eyes is able to instantly conceive this is absurd, and as is the idea that a being could pass on an incomplete eye that would have served no purpose, that eye would have been passed on and then developed in a future generation. So go ahead, Jason. I think that's basically the concept, correct?
You articulated there beautifully. That was exactly my point, and I think it's a really good one to argue against macroevolution. I mean, microevolution, they can actually, you know, observe over time and
correct.
Sort of make sense adapting to your environment.
Correct.
You know? But like you said, with a half-developed organ over, you know, millions of years, I mean, what's the motivation for that, for one? And then there's the whole right. problem of, you know, not being conscious of a visual world. Why would you would be the motivation for an organism to even develop an eye in the first place?
Correct. And once you have an organism that is able to survive long periods of time, why would there be any evolution from that that organism? You know, once a shark becomes a very effective killing machine, why wouldn't that be the terminus of evolution at that point? But the biggest argument that I have against
that they've coined is irreducible complexity, and basically, you know, a half-developed eye serves no purpose,
right?
And it's useless. So, you know, there's no reason for the organism to be motivated to develop it.
Yeah, and it's only one in hundreds of millions of mutations that are positive. You know, 999 every out of every 1,000, in fact, is far worse than that. Mutations are counterproductive. Information is lost. It's very, very difficult to show a mutation, a genetic mutation, where information is gained. It's extraordinarily easy to show a mutation where information is lost. And so to go from less sophisticated and less complex to more complex and more sophisticated, it's just not the way that our genetic code is written. And then you also have the issue of the law of thermodynamics, where things go from order to disorder. They do not go from disorder to order. So, and you know, the example has been made by a number of scientists, which is why the conception of life from inorganic materials is no longer even experimented with in universities anymore, is that the probability of being able to create life, particularly life with a DNA code that's capable of feeding itself and reproducing, out of inorganic materials is far less likely, infinitely less likely than a tornado taking a path through a junkyard. And the result of that is that the junkyard would no longer exist, and there would be a brand new 747 ready to fly coming out of the tornado as it passed over the junkyard. Now, that's about the odds. In fact, it's far worse than that on the chance creation of life. I don't have any issue with microevolution. I think it's us being able to respond and adapt to our environment is a marvelous gift.
One of the points that I think about microevolution was that it happens without there being additional genetic material. Like there's stuff already built in to, you know, grow more hair or, you know, that kind of thing is already built into the genetic material. There's no additional information there.
Yeah, that is correct.
Physical strength and ability.
Yeah, that is correct. The DNA code, which is, of course, the largest molecule that we're aware of, and it's the way that they are scribed, and it's a three-dimensional text. You know, like we read a book, and it's the words, the letters that form words and sentences are written on a two-dimensional construct. DNA is a three-dimensional language, which gives an infinitely greater degree of information. You know, when you go from one dimension to two, you've increased infinitely, not just 50%. And the same thing is true. You go from a language that is two-dimensional to three-dimensional, going with the DNA, you've increased the power and the scope of that infinitely. And you're right that the DNA code that is incumbent is the basis of all life. It carries the capability of doing all the things that we see in the mutations. It was there from the beginning. It's just activated.
That was a good segue into my question.
Okay.
You're also
Please.
Talking about the power of words. And, you know, most of our Torah study so far has been somewhat limited to the lexicons and stuff that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, I was thinking, you know, the original text was a pictographic.
Yes, it was.
Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, isn't there just, I mean, to me it seems that there is a whole untapped gold rush there of, you know, if we could actually start to decipher the pictographs, you have a lexicon built right into the text. And I think the problem is you know, moving out of a sort of, you know, like a modern perspective, I guess, or whatever, you know, the limits we have on our own perspective and, you know, help us get into the not only the context, but letting the letters themselves sort of spell it out for us.
Yeah, what you're saying there is true. I've given it a lot of thought. And I've written a lot about it. We are visual creatures. We come to understanding by literally visualizing things. And the alphabet that Yahweh used to write the ten statements on those two tablets, and the alphabet that Moshe used to transcribe what Yahweh was telling him, is a pictographic alphabet. So it's the first actual alphabet in human history. We have lots of evidence from it now being unearthed throughout Israel. And while it wasn't the first written language, we think that there was a written language in cuneiform that preceded it. But that's not what we consider an alphabet. So the first alphabet is this Paleo-Hebrew script where everything was drawn as a pictogram. And you are correct. You have a built-in lexicon or dictionary to define all of the words that Yahweh uses through this script. And what you find is that, and I will do this with almost all of the important words. We'll take something like Yahweh's name and go through, what do those letters convey? And you find that the name is defined by the depiction of the letters. And Bereth is another one, Torah, I do that. And I probably should do it more. Because
sorry to interrupt.
No.
Looking at the 119th Psalm,
Right.
And do we have a complete script of that? Because the nice thing about that is that you can tell, I mean, is he actually going through every letter? So we have confirmation from Doe that there was 22 letters. And maybe he's telling us something about the letters in each one of those standards.
That's brilliant. Most of our listeners probably know my personal affinity for the 119th Psalm. The 119th Psalm is 176 statements long. It has 8 statements to each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. They're presented in alphabetical order. And each of those 8 stanzas does, in fact, describe the nature of those letters, what's important about each of the letters. It conveys the meaning of those letters as those letters comprise the words that are presented in the Torah. And so he goes through the 22 letters in alphabetical order in this song to the Torah to tell us how to best come to observe the Torah so that we understand it and therefore can respond to it appropriately. And yes, in fact, that is absolutely true, that he has 22 refrains. There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and he goes through them in alphabetical order. And in each one of those stanzas, he highlights the meaning or the message behind the letters that comprise the words. It's why Yahusha, when he was talking about the Torah, he got right down to the strokes that comprise the letters, that comprise the words. And he says, you know, we have it in English, jots and tittles. Well, it's actually the yod, which is the smallest letter in Hebrew. It's the Y, the first letter of Yahweh's name. And the tittles are actually the strokes that comprise the letters themselves. And so he says, you know, the very way that the letters are drawn are going to remain true and in effect and are going to be valuable for as long as the heaven and earth exist. So you're right. We have a built-in lexicon in the way the original letters were drawn. And then we have the most valuable piece of literature in the universe. I think the 119th Psalm, specifically designed to teach us what those letters mean and then how those letters are comprised to form words, where you look at each element that is added to our understanding. Brilliant. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. During the commercial break, I was able to look up in my Dead Sea Scrolls Bible to answer a question that Jason, who's still on the line with us, asked, which was, do we have much of the what's called the 119th Psalm extant from the Dead Sea Scrolls? And the answer is yes. It's actually not the 119th in the Qumran text. It fits between the 132nd and the 135th. The psalm that actually introduces it is really powerful. It speaks in fact, we hear this line I think valuable. It says, "If your sons will observe my covenant, my testimony I will teach them, and they shall sit upon your throne forever." So what God is saying is that if we observe the terms and conditions of the covenant, that we will constantly learn from God, but we'll actually become his heirs, sitting beside him. And he even says, "I will provide this rest for them, and I will dwell with them forever." Well, we've got really a bad connection here. Jason, I put you on hold just because of the noise feedback. Now, the answer to your question specifically on how much of the 119th, what we call the 119th, we have, in my Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, it comprises 7 pages, which they acknowledge that it is by far the longest of the Psalms, and we have more of it than we have from it than we have of any other, fully 7 pages. It's been conveyed reasonably accurately in the Masoretic text. So that's the answer to the question. And I think your comment is brilliant, that Yahweh has provided us with a lexicon, a dictionary, that defines his words through this 119th Psalm, that explains the meaning of every letter. And with those letters, when we combine the meaning of each letter, we come to understand the words, we come to understand the names. So thank you, Jason.
That can actually be found at itg.org.
Yes, it can. In fact, if you go to introtogod.org, the 119th Psalm is presented in its entirety. Its nature, as well as a translation from the Dead Sea Scrolls, is provided for your behalf. If you go to the teaching volume of an intro to just introtogod.org, introtogod.org, if you go to the teaching volume of that book, the third chapter of the teaching volume,
part three,
is where you will find the entire presentation of the 119th Psalm. Well, that said, we have Glenn on the line. Hi, Glenn. How are you? You want to speak? I intend to make a comment on evolution.
I agree with your position about microevolution being demonstrable, but macro being demonstrable. You're one of the few people I know who's nailed that distinction. I've used it for quite a long time. There is no evidence in the fossil record anywhere supporting intergenus evolution. You have kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus,
right.
Species. King Fulcrum's a fairly good stock. And it just amazes me that it's the simplest and most straightforward of all arguments. It's like, show me intergenus, an example of intergenus, you know?
Yeah. And what you say, Glenn, is important because if we all evolved from a common life form, and that we all have roots to that, because there are now 30-some-odd distinct body types in the animal kingdom, you would have to have not one, but you would have to have literally tens of thousands, if not millions, of transitional species between all of these. And there isn't any.
Or have cricket situation,
right.
Or something.
Yeah, you have to have.
Right.
And so the lack of a transitional species is one of many that just game-winning arguments against macroevolution.
A missing link, or a huge number of missing links. However,
oh, yeah.
The evolutionists will pick on you for your
millions of them.
Word, motivation in evolving an eye, because remember, it's predicated on randomness and the law of large numbers. So there is no intent in evolving something that would be creation. So it's just got to be true. And I also point out that we get interesting barbs from the realm of secular music in a lot of issues.
Let me respond to that before we get to your next point. I would say that if something is developed for a purpose and the purpose is unknown prior to the development, to suggest that is random is absolutely idiotic. There is no way to suggest that an eye evolved for the purpose of seeing before seeing was available, would even known as a benefit, and to say that is random. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. Before we return to Glenn, I'd like to share two other insights relative to randomness and time resolving the issue of purposeful motivation for a mutation. First, as it relates to random, as Glenn knows, in fact, that was the first point that he stated. And I'm not arguing against Glenn here, because Glenn's was articulating the perspective of the macroevolutionist. If randomness provided the answer, then rather than seeing no transitional species and no dysfunctional species, we would see billions of dysfunctional species, and we would see billions of transitional species. So randomness clearly cannot be the answer, because there is no evidence of either. As it relates to time, that was the big issue with evolution, where it actually was dealt a fatal blow. And Scientific America actually acknowledged the fatal blow that was dealt to macroevolution theory on the issue of time. The answer was always, we understand that the conception of life from inorganic material is improbable to the point of being impossible. But the impossible becomes possible with eons of time, with billions of years of time. they would argue that the impossibility becomes inevitable. But the problem is that we, through the fossil record, have discovered the Cambrian explosion, where all existing animal life forms came onto the scene at the same time. So that rather than having billions of years, there is no passage of time for all of this, the impossible to become possible. And so, and the only retraction that Scientific American, I think, has ever published, they did a headline story acknowledging that the time is no longer a asset to macroevolutionary theory. In fact, it killed it. All right, Glenn, you were going to make another point. I just wanted to.
I agree with what you just said. I obviously think it's amazing to me that more people don't see how untenable evolution is, but that it's marketed in propaganda to them. And just to remember that in their theory, any benefit is serendipitous. You know, correct. And it just is reinforced. Yeah, so we have a fundamental divide between random serendipity and actual, conscious intent.
But, yeah, that's, by the way, Glenn, why I talked at the beginning of the program about the we're not built for space. You know, our bodies were specifically designed to work on this Earth with this gravity in an upright mode, and we just don't function.
Well, yeah, this is why I don't accept when the talk show host wax effusive about go into the stars and some great future of man, or even they talk about solutions for our present problems. There right. is no solution, and we're not going right. to stars. We're even going into the presence of Yahweh, or we're going nowhere.
You are correct. But, you are correct.
You know, yeah, just going to the stars.
And I also want to make clear that I think you recognize this. I was not debating your point. I happen to agree on everything that you've said. You were simply presenting the evolutionist propaganda, and I thought it would be appropriate to dispel that propaganda.
Oh, yeah, I have to look, we're designed to walk on the surface of the Earth, okay?
We have to
put on five mils of neoprene, over 30 pounds of lead, heavy tanks, oxygen, gas goggles, just to go, 80 feet underwater in the Atlantic to explore a wreck. That's 80 feet. Now, if it takes that much junk to go 80 feet, just below the water on the surface of the Earth, what does it take to go to Mars? And this is furthermore why I don't believe that we have TR3s and TR4s going to Mars.
You can't even breathe the air mixture that we have before us on the surface down much below 80 to 100 feet without it exploding in you. You get what's called the bends, and I've had the bends before.
No, don't need to come up. You've got to do
I understand. I'm a certified diver.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I went nitrox, which feels great anyway, but anyway.
Yes.
Nothing like having that oxygen, 28% yes. oxygen, pumped into you under pressure and then coming up. It's great.
Yes.
But anyway.
Don't do it rapidly. I've gotten the bends, and it's a very painful. But your point is valid that we are designed to work on the surface of this Earth, and we get too far above it or too far below it, our bodies fail us.
Yeah, exactly. I want to shift over to a rebuke. Even in considering the idea of an intentional creator, the atheist would, just as you would rebuke, the Christian God for damning ignorant people to an eternal hell,
right.
presume to ethically rebuke God for the nature of creation on Earth. And I'm sure that you, given your age, have a well-burned-in version of Jethro Tull's Bungle in the Jungle rattling around. And then, when I say, the rivers are full of crocodile nasties, and he who made kittens put snakes in the grass, he's a lover of life but a player of pawns. Yes, the king on his sunset lies waiting for time, blah, blah, blah. So here we see this old, what's old now, this rebuke of the ethics of God in, the placing of the existence of predation in the natural creation and all that sort of thing.
I don't really see that as a negation of creation that animals are predators.
It's an impugning of the ethic. It's an ethical impugning of God creating the eye. You're talking about the eye. Well, God creates eyes. He puts them in mammalian quadruped, herbivores, and then has the carnivore. Them and kill them, and then their eye ceases to function.
Yeah.
The cynical that wonderful eye didn't last very long because the whole animal got eaten.
You know, it's I think that the whole idea of having predators and having us witness death, the end of life through through predators, is an extraordinary lesson for us that we were given mortal existence, that we have a consciousness, a soul, very much like the animals do. We can respond, observe our environment, respond to it, and that a animal can do certain things that prolongs, if it's particularly observant, can prolong its life. And when it ceases to be observant, sometimes the predators end that life prematurely. And I think that lesson is a powerful lesson to us, that life is temporary, this earthly life.
Right, right.
And there is lots of things out there that will kill us. And unless we're particularly observant and aware of our surroundings, it can end all too soon.
Well, Yahweh giveth and Yahweh taketh away, blessed be the name of Yahweh, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? But it's a joke. But one last thing on my way out.
Okay.
Another allusion to secular music that I wanted to bring in, a more modern one.
Even if we
does have to be concerned about the messages being sent to our youth, you know, through pop music and stuff.
Right.
But this is also a somewhat dated song. But Wang Chung's, everybody have fun tonight, everybody, Wang Chung tonight, everybody have fun tonight. In there's this line that says, and all the world is Babylon. All
wow.
the world is Babylon. They tell the
wow.
truth right in the middle of this bizarro
right.
song. And it's like,
yes.
so we have to be in the world, but not of it. But all,
yes.
I mean, I just always crack me up. There's this line in there, and all the world is Babylon. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway. Yeah.
Great insights, Glenn. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. It's amazing. We've talked about how far our conversations with Nick have grown. The same thing can be said by here. That Glenn, almost all of his initial calls to the program were to be, he was quite critical, and now, is one of the, most, insightful contributors, to the program and has come to develop a relationship with, Yahweh. It doesn't make, Glenn perfect, but he's come a long way.
As well.
Yes. Yeah,
I'd like to add something to that that conversation about macroevolution. If everything was just random chance, which of course is asinine, but if it were,
all right.
You know, I trained bodybuilders for years, and I used to, you know, wonder what is this L. You know, all proteins are left-handed.
Right.
You know, they're all. You know, it's like looking at a screwdriver that would be turning counterclockwise.
Right.
And so, imagine you have all these plants and trees. They get eaten by bugs and this and that, but randomly, they're all left-handed. You know, there is no right-handed. I mean, if there was a right-handed one, it would proliferate because nothing could eat it. Nothing
right.
could bother it.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
just as a matter of
50-50. One thing I love about the random chance is sex. How is it that virtually every animal species was created and exists in a male and female form? Did the first one that evolved say, you know, boy, it's really lonely around here. I need myself a woman. Or was the woman the first
right.
and said, I can really use a man to do, you know, to haul out the garbage. You know, how did how did this concept of male and female versions of animals come to exist? I mean, if you were going to have something that was more capable of survival, wouldn't you just have the organism itself be able to replicate itself and not have to deal with male and female forms and the relationships and all of the things that go along with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
I'm saying on a 50-50 level, why didn't a tree come out with a right-handed amino acid? That no, imagine that. No
yes.
bugs could infect it. No disease could get to it.
Yeah.
It would proliferate, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so the whole thing is just so fascinating, you know, when you consider how many of there are, and there's 22, and there's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. When you consider that we're a carbon-based life form, without carbon, DNA is impossible, life is impossible, and the molecular number of carbon is 6, and Yahweh refers to man as 6 in his ultimate equation of 6 plus 1, God being 1,
That's
is equal to 7, which is his idea of perfection, and the next element in terms of its prevalence in the human form is hydrogen, and it has a molecular number of 1, and that that carbon is the right, and then that equals nitrogen, which is next, which has an atomic weight of 7, plus oxygen, which is the catalyst for the energy for all animals, and you recognize that with oxygen, you have a molecular number of 8, so that if you actively engage with your on that formula of 7 of 6 plus 1 equals 7, that you can become immortal, just as the number 8 represents not only in Hebrew but in scientific nomenclature. It's just so fascinating to find the evidences for design. You know, the moment that DNA was discovered, and it was the realization that it was a language, that the language was transcribed to create RNA, and that RNA was translated to create amino acids and proteins. The moment we recognized that it was a language, the game should have been over. At that point, you realize there's no such thing. Welcome back to our final segment of Shattering Myths for today. We've had quite the discussion. I do want to at least get into the passage that I wanted to share today. It is the part of the ongoing conversation. This is actually a minor detour from the conversation that Yahweh was having with Abraham. This is now a conversation not between Yahweh and an individual, but between one of Yahweh's countless number of Malak, his messengers, his envoys. So Yahweh sent one of his envoys to meet with Hagar. Hagar was dying, as was her son. It's a pretty pathetic portrait of a 13-year-old boy off whimpering off in the distance, and the mom trying to carry this 13-year-old boy. But Yahweh is a big fan of choice and a big fan of life. And so Yahweh sent his messenger, and this is how the passage reads. Then the messenger of Yahweh said to her, this would be Hagar, the slave of Sarah. She was an Egyptian. Sarah came up with the harebrained idea that since she was old, that Abraham father a child through Hagar, as opposed to father a child through her. And Ishmael was the product of that harebrained idea that God rejected. Then the messenger of Yahweh said to her, massively numerous your offspring will be, too numerous to count. Now, if we look at that prophetically, he's speaking of Ishmael. Ishmael fades off into the sunset of the word. Really, he makes an appearance upon Abram's death, but he fades off into the wilderness. We don't know a lot about him, but his name was brought back up through the world's second largest religion, Islam. Muhammad claims to be a descendant of Ishmael. Muhammad claims that the blessing of the covenant was through Ishmael and through, therefore, through him. And so Ishmael becomes the basis of Islam. He is the Islamic forefather. And it says here that his offspring will be too numerous to count. You know, in the Islamic world, they don't do censuses like we have in the West. There is no counting how many Muslims there are. No one really knows how many Muslims there are. Then it goes on and says the following. The messenger of Yahweh said to her, pay attention to this. You are pregnant with a son. Call his name Ishmael. And I'll describe Ishmael in a moment. Indeed, Yahweh has heard of your affliction. your poverty and misery, your lowly and wretched nature and utter dependency. You know what defines the name Ishmael by what he says there? And I'm going to tell you honestly that my first trip through this material, I improperly translated Ishmael's name. Ish is individual. Shama is the basis of the name. Shama is the Hebrew word for hears or listens. And El is, means, God. So, the fact that it begins with the Y before Shama, could well be that it's, my God has heard. So this is the messenger, of Yahweh, his Malach, saying that my God has heard. My God has listened to this. My God has heard this pathetic sound, the wailing that is coming from you and from Ishmael. But it is based upon Shama, which means to hear and to listen, El, which is God, and it's either the Yod is either there to indicate that it is God is the one that has heard this, he's aware of this, or it's to create a compound of Ish, which would be individual, who listens to God. Now, I think it really is just God has heard, because what comes next? It says, indeed, Yahweh has heard, Shama, of your affliction. Now, affliction here is oni. And oni in Hebrew is distress and suffering. It's from ana, which is browbeating, looking down, forced oppression, persecution, misery, and tendency to be prostrate. Now, if you want to think about Islam today, what's their signature move? They're prostrate, bowing 5 times a day. When you look at an Islamic country, what do you see? Misery. When you witness Islam trying to assert its influence on the world, what do you see? Oppression. Persecution. And so, that is the description that Yahweh has applied to these people. And when Shattering Misery returns tomorrow, we'll delve more deeply into this prophecy.